Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I do have more to read than time to do it in, so let's get started. Our first article here is The Must List. Conan O'Brien, The Lonely Island, and the Drag Race finale top this week's Must List. See Entertainment Weekly's top pop culture picks for the week of April 19th, including Broadway's Stereophonic and Record Store Day. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. Record Store Day is touted below, so I'll take this opportunity to sing from the rafters about a new album out today, the original Broadway cast recording of The Notebook. I caught the emotional new twist on the hit book and movie a few weeks ago, and folk pop artist Ingrid Michaelson's score isn't jazz hands catchy, but her stirring songs stay with you. Enjoy My Days, sung by Joy Woods, my current favorite Broadway star after seeing her as Audrey in Little Shop of Horrors last year, as a prime example. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. The first on the must list is Conan O'Brien Must Go. Conan O'Brien takes his clueless and curious American act to Norway, Argentina, Thailand, and Ireland in this freewheeling travelogue streaming on Max. Along the way, the host podcaster connects with fans, clumsily attempts local activities, and argues with his producer and nemesis, Jordan Schlansky, about the proper pronunciation of tango. The Lonely Island and Seth Meyers podcast. The iconic comedy trio joins the former Saturday Night Live head writer to delve into each of their digital shorts, both the beloved and lesser known. Most recently, they covered Lazy Sunday, which helped establish YouTube as we know it. We love the chronic what-ols of Saturday Night Live history. They were kind of combining chronic and chronicles there. Okay. Stereophonic is next. Go inside a 1976 recording studio to watch a band on the brink of both stardom and implosion. With original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler and a stellar cast including Succession's Juliana Canfield and the marvelous Mrs. Maisel's Will Brill, this captivating new Broadway play hits all the right notes. RuPaul's Drag Race finale. Bananas, burger fingers, and a tiny bouncing breastplate collide on the MTV reality juggernaut's season 16 finale, the first to feature just three finalists since season 8. Whether Nymphia Wind, Plain Jane, or Sapphira Cristal takes the $200,000 prize, this remixed final episode format will be a prize for us all. Record Store Day. Imagine an early alternate version of David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust album with four songs that didn't make the cut. Now, go buy it! That gem is one of almost 400 titles available on Record Store Day, out April 20th, including a split single from Olivia Rodrigo and Noah Kahan, demos from The Ramones, and live albums from De La Soul, The Replacements, and Talking Heads. Get shopping! I'll add a little more context here in that Record Store Day is an annual event inaugurated in 2007 to celebrate the culture and the independently owned record store. Held one Saturday every April and every Black Friday in November, the day brings together fans, artists, and thousands of independent record stores around the world. That was from Wikipedia. And that was this week's must list by the Entertainment Weekly staff. In TV, we have a Fallout review, an addictive post-apocalyptic adventure. Ella Purnell and Walton Goggins star in Prime Video's adaptation of the blockbuster video game franchise. This is by Kristen Baldwin. In the fourth episode of Fallout, the ghoul, played by Walton Goggins, drags his prisoner, Lucy, played by Ella Purnell, across the sun-bleached, sandy wasteland of post-nuclear apocalypse California. A zombie-esque former human mutated by radiation, the ghoul has spent the last 219 years cementing his reputation as the irradiated desert's deadliest bounty hunter. Lucy is new to the surface world, having been raised in the orderly safety of Vault 33, one of dozens of subterranean communities established by citizens who fled underground before the war began. Self-interest and violence are anathema to her. She even tries to appeal to her captor by reminding him of the Golden Rule. It doesn't work. While the ghoul is momentarily distracted, Lucy runs. A struggle ensues, during which Lucy bites off his right index finger and he, in turn, saws hers off with a machete. Holding the bloody digit aloft, the ghoul gives Lucy a look that almost connotes respect. "Now, that right here," he says, "is the closest thing we've had to an honest exchange so far." Consider this the guiding principle of Fallout. If a nihilist and an optimist can just learn to communicate, there could be hope for humanity yet. Adapted from the blockbuster video game franchise by Westworld's Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan, this vast apocalyptic adventure interrogates the concept of human survival through the lens of morality and justice. The 8-episode season exists in a vivid and captivating universe that will be familiar to gamers, though knowledge of the franchise isn't required to enjoy its darkly comic dystopian pleasures. Fallout begins with the episode named The End. Quite literally, the words flash on the screen, all caps, as our welcome. It's the year 2077 in alternate reality, America, a place where the culture of the 1950s, with all its Western-loving, pinko-hating patriotic gusto, never died. Actor and well-known movie cowboy Cooper Howard, played by Goggins, is performing at a child's birthday party in Los Angeles when the bomb drops. The culmination of a 10-year global resource war, decimating much of the life on Earth. Flash forward 2 centuries, an emergency drives Lucy McLean, the aforementioned apple-cheeked resident of Vault 33, to the surface seeking answers. There she must contend with unlimited dangers. Think the ghoul, giant meat-eating cockroaches, a massive pink lizard-like abomination known as a gulper, among other horrors. The Fallout universe, both before and after the Great War, is a place where society is deeply divided, and every group thinks the other is a cult. Sound familiar? Before the bombs dropped, those who supported America's fight abroad and companies like Vault Tech, which profited from it, were labeled warmongers and evil capitalists. Everyone else? Communists. In the post-war world, Vault dwellers like Lucy are viewed by those on the surface as brainwashed automatrons at best, cowards at worst. The wasteland itself is a battleground for dueling factions. There's the Brotherhood of Steel, a brutal military force that uses knights in robotic power armor suits to confiscate any and all technology. Others follow Moldover, played by the always welcome Sarita Chaudhuri, a quote-unquote madwoman who presides over a compound of armed acolytes deep in the desert. Both organizations believe they alone know how to save the human race from itself, and both will shed as much blood as it takes to achieve their goals. Into this morass of cruelty and savagery comes Lucy McLean, the only person in a 1,000-mile radius who believes mankind should work for the greater good. Though the ghoul taunts Lucy that the wasteland will make her a killer, Fallout allows her a hero's journey that intertwines the loss of her innocence with the effect of her altruism on others. Specifically, Maximus, played by Aaron Morton, an orphan-turned-squire in the Brotherhood of Man, who's been beaten down so much by life and his Brotherhood peers, he views everyone as an opponent to be defeated. As their incongruously sweet romance unfolds, Lucy introduces Maximus to the power of community. In the vaults, we recognize that we all need each other. The mythology is dense. As a non-gamer, I utilized a lot of pre-existing Fallout wikis and explainers created by the online community to fill in some blanks. What is a Pip-Boy? Why are bottle caps used as currency? And we haven't even gotten to Wilzig, played by Michael Emerson, who works in the behavioral engineering department of a military-run government organization called the Enclave. Or Lucy's brother, Norm, played by Moises Arias, who uncovers some ominous secrets about the vault system after she's gone. Despite its Westworld pedigree, Nolan also directs the first three episodes, Fallout has a sense of humor about its characters and the dire situations they endure. Showrunners Geneva Robertson-Dvorit, we know from Captain Marvel, and Graham Wagner, who we know from Silicon Valley, foster more of a Watchmen vibe, grounding their alternate reality in fundamental truths and juxtaposing the more cartoonish elements with weighty themes, including xenophobia, eugenics, and the corrupting influence of capitalism on governance. One plea, however, to producers of all prestige apocalypse dramas, it's time to bury slow-mo battle scenes set to Nat King Cole and Glenn Miller in a TV time capsule for a century, at least. Lucy is the audience's surrogate, but the series doesn't champion any one ideology. Even the good guys have their prejudices. These people, am I right? Says Vault Overseer, venting about surface dwellers. If you want to get elected, you have to respect their traditions and tolerate them and not call them surfies. It's awful. He's played by Chris Parnell, one of many wonderful actors. Dallas Goldtooth, Dale Dickey, Matt Berry, who pop up in Fallout's expansive ensemble. Goggins, who just gave three Emmy-worthy performances last summer in I'm a Virgo, Justified, City Primeval, and The Righteous Gemstones, lords over Fallout as the ghoul, a merciless mercenary with a whiskey-smooth drawl and a devilish grin. Not even layers of burn scar prosthetics can dampen the actor's immutable charm. Purnell leavens her character's perky patriotism with a necessary dash of self-awareness. Lucy may be naive about the sometimes hostile strangers she encounters, but she never begrudges them their humanity. Moten makes Maximus a wonderfully endearing doofus, and Arias brings a mournful cynicism to Norm, who seems to be the only resident of Vault 33 who is born without an inherent sense of purpose. Usually, the complaint about puzzle box shows is that they withhold too many answers from the viewer. Fallout, by contrast, downloads almost too much information in the season one finale. Prime Video, which has no consistent release pattern for its originals, chose to drop all eight episodes of Fallout at once. It's too bad. The show would have benefited from a weekly rollout, giving fans more time to rewatch, digest, dissect, and debate its intricate story threads. But that's just my opinion. There is, after all, no one right way to handle the end of the world. All eight episodes of Fallout are streaming on Prime Video, and that was the Fallout review. It's an addictive post-apocalyptic adventure. Kristen Baldwin was the author of that review, and she's giving it a grade of B+. Here's a review of Under the Bridge, a truly depressing true crime drama. Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone star in this adaptation of Rebecca Godfrey's book about the murder of Rena Virk. This is also by Kristen Baldwin. The first episode of Under the Bridge, Hulu's relentlessly grim new true crime drama, writer Rebecca Godfrey, played by Riley Keough, comes home to Victoria, British Columbia, for the first time in 10 years. She's flown in from New York to research her next book about the misunderstood girls of her gorgeous but gloomy coastal town. Growing up, Rebecca was one of them, a rebellious kid who hid pot under the floorboards in her bedroom and partied with friends at an abandoned warehouse. She never really wanted to come back to Victoria, but the muse of her past misery beckons. Early on in her visit, Rebecca hears about Rena Virk, played by Vritika Gupta, a local 14-year-old girl who went missing after going to an outdoor party. Sensing a hook for her story, Rebecca begins chatting up a band of teenagers, including Josephine Bell, played by Chloe Guidry, and Dusty Pace, played by Ayana Goodfellow, who live at the Seven Oaks Foster Care Group Home, and Kelly Allard, played by Izzy G, and Warren Glowatsky, played by Javon Walton, who were among the last people to see Rena alive. Rebecca's informal investigation pushes her into an awkward reunion with Officer Cam Bentland, played by Lily Gladstone, who was her best friend until about a decade ago when a mysterious falling out ended their relationship. Over the course of the season, Under the Bridge jumps between past and present timelines, chronicling Rena's final days, including her clashes with her mother, played by Archie Panjabi, a devout Jehovah Witness, and the investigation into her murder, as Rebecca and Cam sort through the rumors and lies to uncover who killed her and why. The more we learn about Rena and the Seven Oaks girls she so desperately wanted to impress, the clearer it becomes that the most terrifying thing about this story is its underlying mundanity. That fleeting mean girl squabbles and adolescent angst could lead to an utterly senseless death. But writer Quinn Shepherd from Blame, who adapted Godfrey's book for the screen, clutters Under the Bridge with several half-formed plots that dilute the power of narrative about sad, mad, and lonely kids channeling their pain into violence. The real Rebecca Godfrey, who passed away in 2022, wrote Under the Bridge from the perspective of the kids and investigators involved. The series, however, makes Rebecca a key protagonist. It's an understandable impulse, given Godfrey's ability to put the teen subjects at ease, which allowed them to tell her things they wouldn't admit to other adults. Still, the show can't decide if it's Rebecca's, and to a lesser degree Cam's, story, or the story of Rena and the kids who ended her life so callously. From the outside, it's clear the focus should be on the latter, but that poses a more practical problem. Would Hulu really gamble on a character-driven drama starring a group of mostly unknown young actors, excellent as they are? Probably not. So Keough and Gladstone loom large on the poster, and Under the Bridge is obligated to place a clumsy emphasis on the strained, vaguely defined relationship between Rebecca and Cam. Even six episodes in, when the two have a blowout fight over their conflicting interests in Rena's case, it still isn't clear what the precise source of their pent-up anger and frustration actually was. The confrontation is well-acted, but unearned. Despite the uneven writing, the performances in Under the Bridge are consistently superb. The young actors are particularly impressive. Gupta, whose cherubic face belies an underlying intensity, vividly conveys Rena's impotent teenage anger, while Guidry reveals the fragile spirit under Josephine's wannabe gangster bluster. Izzy G brings a chilling edge to Kelly's teenage insouciance, and Goodfellow is sweet and sympathetic as Dusty, who can't summon the courage to do the right thing. Walton, who used his baby face to such discomfiting effect as Euphoria's Astray, is absolutely heartbreaking as Warren, a soft-spoken, neglected kid grappling with anguish he just can't process. Keough plays Rebecca with a kind of dreamy and alluring reserve, though her interactions with Warren veer uncomfortably close to flirtation. If that was the intent, okay. Gladstone elevates Cam beyond the character's stern yet concerned cop framework. Though a subplot concerning Cam's native ancestry, she was adopted into a white family as a baby, feels shoehorned in. At least it gives Gladstone another emotional avenue to explore. Punjabi is reliably affecting as Rena's shattered mother, Suman, and American Idol contender turned actor Anoop Desai is a standout as Rena's kind and understanding Uncle Raj. "You poisoned our life, and I need it to stop," Suman tells one of the accused killers. "I forgive you. It's the only way out of all of this." It's a devastating scene and one that underscores the difficulty of watching the terrible story of Rena Virk's death unfold. True crime shows, whether scripted or documentary, are almost always depressing, but seeing the perpetrators caught and held accountable can make the experience more bearable. With Under the Bridge, though, the justice is yet another tragedy. More young lives are destroyed to pay for the one so pointlessly taken. Under the Bridge premiered Wednesday, April 17th on Hulu. That was Kristen Baldwin's review, and she's giving Under the Bridge a grade of B-. And here's one more TV review. We Were the Lucky Ones, a heartening story of Holocaust survival. Joey King and Logan Lerman star in Hulu's limited series based on the best-selling historical novel. This is also by Kristen Baldwin. It's always daunting to press play on a TV show, movie, or documentary about the Holocaust. As necessary and important as these stories are, they're also agonizing. And Hulu's new limited series, We Were the Lucky Ones, about a Polish family forced to scatter across multiple continents during World War II, is a tough watch. But those who brave this moving limited series based on Georgia Hunter's historical novel will also find it to be edifying, educational, and ultimately rewarding. The 8-episode drama introduces us to Helena Kirk, played by Joey King, a young woman living with her family in Radom, Poland, in 1938. It's Passover, and Helena's parents, Sol, played by Lior Ashkenazi, and Nechuma, played by Robin Wiegert, are giddily awaiting the return of their son Addie, played by Logan Lerman, a musician who lives in Paris. The family is thriving. Sol and Nechuma own a successful fabric store. Their sons, Ganik, played by Henry Lloyd Hughes, and Jacob, played by Amit Rav, are training to be lawyers. Addie's latest composition is a radio hit, and their daughter, Mila, played by Hadras Yaron, is expecting her first child with her doctor husband, Salim, played by Michael Aloni. Still, fears about Hitler's growing ambition and rising anti-Semitism across Europe have begun to infiltrate the periphery of their cheery existence. "It'll pass," Ganek assures Addie. "Radom is not Germany." His optimism, as we now know, is misguided. The premiere, written by showrunner Erica Lopez, from The Morning Show and Bates Motel, carefully cultivates a feeling of creeping dread. A Jewish man with a black eye smoking a cigarette outside a Radom cafe. A man walking the streets of Paris in a government-issued gas mask, as the dangers facing the continent become harder to ignore. Before the hour is over, the Germans have invaded Poland, launching the Kirk family into a years-long nightmare. Inspired by the true story of Hunter's ancestors, We Were the Lucky Ones, sprawling narrative explores how the Nazis' reign of terror reached far beyond the borders of the death camps, and why survival offered no escape from the horrors. Sol, Nechuma, Mila, and her daughter, played by Artemisia Pagliano, are pushed out of their homes and forced into factory work. Helena and Bella, played by Eva Feiler, Jacob's girlfriend, make a dangerous trek to Soviet-occupied Lvov to find him. Janik and his wife, Herta, played by Moran Rosenblatt, are sent to a brutal Russian-controlled work camp. Addie attempts to flee to Brazil, but winds up trapped in Nazi-sympathizing Dakar. Though their circumstances are extremely varied, every member of the Kirk family is surrounded by the threat of death. Pogroms, mass shootings, starvation, backbreaking labor, the flagrant cruelty of SS soldiers, etc. But Lucky Ones also emphasizes the invisible torture that's intrinsic to the daily act of survival. You need to laugh more when Germans tell jokes, Helena scolds Mila after they decide to conceal their identity. No Jewish eyes. If we look as sad as we feel, we might as well just announce ourselves. Even as their torment worsens every passing year, the Kirk family defies the Nazis' evil by refusing to succumb to it. Faith is a choice, says Herta. It's an act of will. That theme, which recurs through countless other Holocaust survival stories, is what makes the tragedy of Lucky Ones bearable. As the feisty and quick-witted Helena, King is the emotional engine of the series. Attacking her character's ordeal with passionate defiance, the actress ensures that the Kirk family's intense yearning for a reunion underscores her every scene. Both she and Ashkenazi, as Helena's steadfast father Saul, even manage to get a few laughs, which is no small feat in a Holocaust drama. And Lehrman, an actor whose boyish mien can veer suave or heartbreakingly fragile, melds easily with the charismatic Addie. For Jewish survivors, the struggles of World War II didn't end on VE Day. The excruciating wait for updates on family members from the Red Cross, the jarring shift back to freedom after years of oppression, the return to cities that no longer feel like home. We Were the Lucky Ones touches too briefly on these rich themes in its 73-minute finale. But it also gifts viewers with much-needed moments of ugly cry uplift and a reminder that there are some stories we should never stop telling. We Were the Lucky Ones premiered on March 28th on Hulu, and Kristen Baldwin is giving it a grade of B+. I'll take a moment here to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. From the movie section, I have how Alan Ritchson made Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare more violent than Guy Ritchie wanted. He was almost angry about it, Ritchson says, of the creative argument he had with the director. This is by Sidney Buxbaum. Alan Ritchson says he had always dreamed of working with Guy Ritchie, but when the opportunity finally came along, the experience was a wake-up call to the realities of working alongside a director with a singular creative vision. He's so particular. He knows just what he wants the aesthetic of a character to be, Ritchson tells Entertainment Weekly of his Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare director. He'll come in and tweak your beanie just sideways enough to look cool, and he will tilt your glasses just so to make sure that everything's got the look that he wants. But when it comes to the creative... Ritchson pauses and laughs before continuing, I'm just glad I worked at the character, the dialect, and the script so much before getting to set so I can understand the character, learning archery before coming out so that it was all in place because what we ended up shooting on the day is all completely new. Ritchson had no idea that the legendary director would tell him to throw out the script and improv for the majority of filming. I had memorized the entire script before I got out there because I was so nervous about playing this character with this high English accent that was learned through a Danish aristocracy. It's a very difficult accent, he says. I learned every line with a dialect coach, and then I come in and Guy's like, forget about that. We're not shooting that movie. The real movie's going to be the one we find on set. So suddenly, we're just improvising scenes, and I'm hoping that I've got this character and this accent right, but that was horrifying for me. Ritchson stars with Henry Cavill, Aiza Gonzalez, Alex Pettifer, Henry Golding, and Carrie Ilves in the comedic action film that's out April 19th. that's based on real historical events uncovered in recently declassified British War Department files about the creation of the first ever Special Forces organization in World War II. The espionage group had a major impact on the Allies' eventual victory over the Nazis, which is why Richson felt added pressure portraying his character, decorated Danish soldier and real-life war hero Anders Lassen. I really wanted to pay respect to Anders Lassen and to the team of people that paved the way for the rest of us to have real freedoms and equality, Richson says. That story matters, even though it's definitely got this almost fanciful spin on it with the Guy Ritchie fingerprint. We're still talking about the thematics that are really important, so I wanted to get this guy right. And he was an animal. He was the first to campaign to make the bow and arrow an official weapon of war, and got it done. That's why Richson spent every waking second that he had in between training and shooting season 2 of his Prime Video action series Reacher, learning how to expertly use a bow and arrow. Me and my stuntman, Ryan Terran, who's been a double of mine for a while now, would go train together at an archery course to the point where we would be prepared for any scenario that we'd find on set, he says. I could run and dive and slide and shoot arrows from any position, moving forward or backwards. And all that training paid off, since he had literally no time in between wrapping Reacher Season 2 and filming Ministry. I wrapped Reacher Season 2 on a Saturday. I flew on Sunday, landed at 11:30 at night in Turkey, had to go straight to the fitting so that I had wardrobe for the next day, because I went to bed, got up in the morning at 7, and I'm on set, Richson says. And the first thing Guy has me do is, he's like, see that twig over there? I want you to shoot that twig and then shoot these guards and then march down to the fence. All right, here we go. He laughs as he adds, no preparation. We're just flicking these arrows. And it was fine. It was fine because we'd worked really hard at it. And as production continued, Richson was even more grateful for his extracurricular prep as he learned just how on the fly Ritchie's directing style was, even for the action scenes. I realized once we got there that there wasn't really a plan for the action, he explains, but it's a war movie, and we're going into these enemy encampments and slaughtering Nazis, and I read 4 books about my character before we got there, and this man hated Nazis. He put all his physical energy into stopping this movement, and so he was inventive and creative, and he was sinister in a way that he could go about doing it. And he was cunning. And there was really no plan for the action. I felt like we were missing that, and we needed to see that on screen. That's when Richson made a risky career move by getting into a creative argument with Ritchie, where he fought for his vision to make the movie even more violent. I told Guy, look, man, if we're going to do this action sequence tomorrow, I don't think it could be something where we just throw a dagger and dispense a couple guys, Richson says. This guy hates Nazis, so this should be murder. This should be malice-filled. He came from Danish aristocracy. Half his family sided with the Nazis, and half his family did not sympathize. And so there was a civil war in his own family. They were killing cousins and brothers. That really left a scar in his family. So when he survived and fought back against this movement, it was very personal. So I was pitching this idea that this should feel incredibly personal when he goes to kill these Nazis. There's real bloodlust there. Richson laughs as he remembers, Guy looked at me like I was nuts. And he was like, I don't know, man. It took some convincing from one of Ritchie's producing partners who supported Richson's vision to at least give the idea a chance. Richson and Terran worked all day and night to design a brutal sequence to show Ritchie the next day. Guy walked onto the set and he was like, where do I sit to see this? He was almost angry about it. He was like, show me. The action sequence follows Anders in hand-to-hand combat, making his way through the inner hallways of a ship and taking down the many hordes of Nazis in his path. And Guy loved it, Richson reveals. He was like, great, love it, shoot it, have fun. And he leaves. We then spent all day making what we had pitched, and it's in the movie and it's in the trailer. When you think of the action of this movie, that's what you think of, that scene. It's hyper-aggressive, but it's action-filled with a different kind of purpose than a lot of the action movies we get. I don't think there's a greater motivation than what Anders Lassen was fighting for. After successfully convincing producers to increase the stunt performer count from 10 to 20 for the extended action sequence, Richson faced one more problem: finding an adversary who could believably overpower him. There was a moment where we were trying to have a guy come out of a doorway and take me down, and no one was big enough or experienced enough to do it well, he admits with a laugh. So he convinced his own body double, Taryn, to put on a sailor costume and beat the crap out of me instead. By the end of that fight, he and I were high-fiving because we got all the things we wanted. We got all the kills that we wanted. It was super stylish and cool, and we even got to axe a couple Nazis. That was a proud day where we just dreamed that up on the fly, and it worked. Throughout the filming, but especially when he convinced Richie to follow his violent vision, Richson gained a new confidence. This is still what I was born to do. I can actually get into a creative argument with Guy and go, dude, I think you're wrong about this. Let me show you why I think we should do this. And convince him to give something a shot that ends up in the movie and ends up adding value, he says. I've fought these fights with the best filmmakers in the world now and come out on the other side better for it. It's not that I'll never be nervous again, but if I can do that and I can work in that environment under those conditions, there's nothing I can't do. This was life-changing for me, really, seriously, in a big way. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare opened in theaters April 19th. That was how Alan Richson made the movie more violent than Guy Ritchie wanted, and it was by Sidney Buxbaum. Samuel L. Jackson says Pulp Fiction changed his life. People started thinking I was the coolest mother effer on the planet. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. With the words "a royale with cheese" and a wallet embroidered with "bad mother effer," Samuel L. Jackson became a star. Jackson was working steadily by the time he booked Pulp Fiction, often appearing in the films of Spike Lee, but he didn't become a true screen presence until he donned Jules Winfield's black and white suit in the 1994 Quentin Tarantino film. Reminiscing about the project at a 30th anniversary screening that opened the 15th annual TCM Classic Film Festival, Jackson explained in his inimitable fashion how the film altered the course of his career. It changed my life drastically, he said, in that I think this was the particular role that all of a sudden people started thinking I was the coolest mother effer on the planet. So I'm happy with that. Jackson, 75, also recalled that the change in his status was particularly noticeable when the film premiered at the 1994 Cannes Film Festival. Bruce Willis and I flew to Cannes, he remembered, and I was with all these guys, and we got out of the car, and they're like, oh my God, John Travolta! Oh my God, Bruce Willis! Oh my God, who is that black guy? Besides the fact that he plays Jules to perfection, Jackson has another theory as to why the role proved to be such a breakout for him and a boost to the careers of the film's other cast members. It's all in Tarantino's copious dialogue. Watching a lot of films, you realize at a certain point that an actor only talks one-third of the film, Jackson explained. The rest of the film is people doing S. So when I read that script, I was like, this is amazing. I immediately flipped it back over and read it again to be sure I wasn't making myself crazy, and I wanted to be in this movie so bad that I was making it up that it was that good. He continued, but it was, And part of the reason was because those characters were talking to each other and about things, sometimes innocuous things, but they were talking. I was coming from the theater, and that's what we do in theater. We don't have the advantage of get in the car and drive. I was very overjoyed that I was going to be able to run my mouth that much in a movie. Now, we get to share that joy every time we watch. The 15th annual TCM Classic Film Festival runs April 18th through the 21st. That was Samuel L. Jackson saying Pulp Fiction changed his life, and it was by Maureen Lee Lanker. Already, we have some 2024 Emmy nomination predictions. No, you're right, the Emmys aren't for a while, but here are all the main acting categories, and these are always interesting because they can give us a clue as to what the good shows are. These are Entertainment Weekly's picks for who will earn nods for Best Lead and Supporting Actor and Actress in a Comedy, Drama, and Limited Series. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Who needs a break from the Emmy race? Don't answer that. The 2023 ceremonies, which aired in 2024, is barely behind us, but it's already time for the 2024 Emmy season. So, it's time to get those prediction juices flowing. Here are our picks for which performers in series and TV movies airing between June 1st, 2023 and May 31st, 2024 have a good shot at landing on the ballot when nominations are announced in July. For lead actress in a drama, there's Imelda Staunton from The Crown, Carrie Coon from The Gilded Age, Emma Stone from The Curse, Maya Erskine for Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Jennifer Aniston in The Morning Show, and Juliette Binoche for The New Look. With The Crown and The Morning Show as the only repeat contenders, the acting race here and in all other drama categories will be refreshingly unpredictable. Oh, and let's hope Emma Stone took a nice long nap after Oscar season because she's about to hit the circuit again as a frontrunner for Showtime's inexplicable and unforgettable The Curse. Also in the mix, Reese Witherspoon and Rosario Dawson. There are some deserving dark horses. They're calling out Carrie Preston for Elsbeth, Ella Purnell for Fallout. The two shows couldn't be more different. One's a broadcast TV spinoff / whodunit of the week. The other's a big-budget streaming adaptation of a blockbuster video game franchise. Both, however, draw us in through female characters who remain chipper and in control even when facing trying circumstances, murder investigations, or nuclear apocalypse. For lead actor in a drama, we are seeing Gary Oldman for Slow Horses, Dominic West for The Crown, Donald Glover for Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Tom Hiddleston for Loki, Idris Elba for Hijack, and Walton Goggins for Fallout. It may have taken three seasons, but word of mouth on Slow Houses finally reached U.S. awards voters this year. You can expect Gary Oldman to follow his Golden Globe nomination with a nod in this category. Even more exciting, this will be the year Walton Goggins gets his long overdue second Emmy nomination, and maybe even a third. Also in the mix is Colin Farrell for Sugar, Nathan Fielder for The Curse, Ben Mendelsohn for The New Look, Morgan Spector from The Golden Age, Timothy Oliphant for Justified, City Primeval, and Adrian Brody for Winning Time, Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. In their deserving Dark Horse category, it's Zane McLaren for Dark Winds. If the world were a just place, the always excellent McLaren would be top of mind in this category as a supporting actor in a comedy for Reservation Dogs. Supporting actress in a drama. We have Elizabeth Debicki for The Crown, Leslie Manville for The Crown, Christine Baranski and Cynthia Nixon for The Gilded Age, Kirsten Scott Thomas for Slow Horses, and then Greta Lee, Nicole Beharie, and Holland Taylor all for The Morning Show. Attention, sprawling ensembles of The Morning Show and The Gilded Age. The White Lotus is on Emmy hiatus, which means your time has come. Also in the mix is Audra McDonald for The Gilded Age and Celia Rose Gooding for Star Trek Strange New World. In their deserving Dark Horse category, Amy Ryan for Sugar. Hey voters, remember how you never nominated Ryan for her impeccable work in The Wire or The Office or In Treatment? Welp, she's about to kill it again as a missing woman's alcoholic stepmom in Sugar, so it's not too late to right those past wrongs. For supporting actor in a drama, we have Billy Crudup for The Morning Show, along with John Hamm and Mark Duplass. We have Jonathan Pryce and Khalid Abdallah in The Crown. There's Benny Safdie in The Curse, Ki-Huy Quan in Loki, and Nathan Lane in The Gilded Age. Another wide-open category, thanks to the absence of The White Lotus for now, and Succession for good, like Walton Goggins. Nearly a decade after his only Emmy win for Mad Men, John Hamm has a real shot at 2 nominations this season, both here and in the limited series category. Also in the mix, Jack Lowden for Slow Horses and Ken Watanabe for Tokyo Vice. Our deserving dark horses, Kristen Bauer for Heels, truly just screaming into the void here, but boy, did Chris Bauer do Emmy-worthy work as Wild Bill Hancock, an abrasive and mostly reformed sleazeball wrestler turned scout in this underrated and now canceled drama. For lead actress in a comedy, there's Ayo Dedebiri for The Bear, Jean Smart on Hacks, Devery Jacobs on Reservation Dogs, Selena Gomez, Only Murders in the Building, and Quinta Brunson, Abbott Elementary. The Bear's Adebiri won just a few months ago in the supporting actress category, but for season 2, she's graduating to lead actress, where she'll likely join the perennial nominees club with Brunson and Smart. Also in the mix is Kristen Wiig for Palm Royale and Maya Rudolph for Loot and Sarah Lancashire for Julia. Deserving dark horse is Natasha Dimitriou for What We Do in the Shadows. Though the vampire mockumentary has been nominated before in 2020 and 2022, the players in its excellently eccentric ensemble have yet to break through in the acting categories. And there's no better place to start than with Dimitriou's batty brilliance as Nadja of Antipaxos. For lead actor in a comedy, we've got Jeremy Allen White in The Bear, Martin Short and Steve Martin for Only Murders in the Building, Jarell Jerome in I'm a Virgo, and Larry David for Curb Your Enthusiasm. Compared to other races this Emmy season, the comedy actor category almost feels stagnant. But Jarell Jerome, adorably naive and dorky as I'm a Virgo's 13-foot-tall teenager, will be a welcome infusion of fresh blood. Also in the mix, Kelsey Grammer for Frasier, DeFaro Wunate for Reservation Dogs, and Theo James in The Gentlemen. The deserving dark horses are Matt Berry, Kyvan Novak, both for What We Do in the Shadows. Nominate all the vampires, dang it! For supporting actress in a comedy, there's Meryl Streep for Only Murders in the Building. In Abbott Elementary, we have Cheryl Lee Ralph, Janelle James, and Lisa Ann Walter. There's Hannah Einbinder for Hacks, and Abby Elliott and Lisa Colon Zayas, both for The Bear. There are a few open spaces on the ballot this time around, given the end of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which earned Alex Borenstein 5 nominations in this category, and Ted Lasso, co-starring 3-time nominees Juno Temple and Hannah Waddingham. That will be good news for Abbott's Lisa Ann Walter, no eating her feelings this year, and The Bear's Lisa Colon Zayas. Also in the mix, Carol Burnett for Palm Royale, Polina Alexis for Reservation Dogs, and Molly Gordon in The Bear. And the deserving dark horse, Megan Staller from Hacks. Our sole wish for season 3, more of Stalter's chaotic energy as Hollywood's best at being the worst assistant Kayla. For supporting actor in a comedy, there taking a guess for Eben Moss Bachrach for The Bear, along with Lionel Boyce and Oliver Platt for the same show, Tyler James Williams for Abbott Elementary, Bowen Yang for Saturday Night Live, along with Kenan Thompson, and Paul Rudd for Only Murders in the Building. The Bear is the new Ted Lasso, and we're not mad about it. If Matty Matheson edges his way onto the ballot, we'd be okay with that too. Also in the mix, Matty Matheson for The Bear, Harvey Guillen for What We Do in the Shadows, Carl Clemens Hopkins for Hacks, Paul W. Downs for Hacks, Chris Perfetti for Abbott Elementary, and Marcelo Hernandez for Saturday Night Live. And the deserving dark horse is Walton Goggins for I'm a Virgo. In Fallout, he plays a gunslinging abomination called the Ghoul. In Virgo, he's something even scarier, a domineering billionaire who takes it upon himself to police the streets. And lead actress in a limited series or movie, we've got Jodie Foster for True Detective Night Country, Juno Temple for Fargo, Anna Sawai for Shogun, Brie Larson, Lessons in Chemistry, Naomi Watts for Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, and Kate Winslet for The Regime. Pay no attention to The Regime's negative reviews. Voters love Kate Winslet. And to be fair, she's not the reason that the series doesn't work. Also in the mix, Sofia Vergara for Griselda, Awkwafina for Quiz Lady, Aria Mia Liberti for All the Light We Cannot See, and Sinclair Daniel for The Other Black Girl. And the deserving dark horse is Joey King in We Were the Lucky Ones. Allow myself to quote myself. As the feisty and quick-witted Helena, King is the emotional engine of the series, about a Polish family forced to scatter during World War II. And we'll also get in here lead actor in a limited or anthology series or movie. There's Tom Hollander for Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, Hiroyuki Sanada for Shogun, John Hamm for Fargo, Andrew Scott for Ripley, Tony Shalhoub for Mr. Monk's Last Case, and Matt Bomer for Fellow Travelers. This category is in a state of flux due to a rush of male-heavy spring entries, Franklin, Eric, The Sympathizer, and Ripley, but Hollander, Sanada, and Hamm will hold down the fort until voters get the rest sorted. Also in the mix, Michael Douglas in Franklin, David Oyelowo for Lawman, Bass Reeves, Tobias Menzies for Manhunt, Hoa Sunande in The Sympathizer, and Benedict Cumberbatch for Eric. The deserving dark horse is Logan Lerman from We Were the Lucky Ones. The former child actor brings an endearing warmth to his role as a Polish composer fighting to reunite with his family during World War II. Can I get in one more? I think I can. It's supporting actress in a limited series or movie. They're calling out Kaylee Reese for True Detective Night Country, Jennifer Jason Leigh in Fargo, for Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, I see here Chloe Sevigny and Diane Lane. It's Aja Naomi King in Lessons in Chemistry, Sandra Oh in The Sympathizer, and Lily Gladstone in Under the Bridge. The first season of Feud earned 19 nominations back in 2017, and the starry sophomore season will likely do just as well. Also in the mix, Calista Flockhart in Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, Andrea Riseborough for The Regime, and Dakota Fanning in Ripley. And the deserving dark horse, Sarayu Blue from Expats. Known for her comedic roles, the actress gives a standout dramatic performance in Prime Video's adaptation of the Janice Y.K. Lee's novel. And for supporting actor in a limited series or movie, we have Robert Downey Jr. in The Sympathizer, Joe Keery for Fargo, Jonathan Bailey in Fellow Travelers, Lewis Pullman, Lessons in Chemistry, John Hawkes, True Detective Night Country, Treat Williams in Feud, Capote vs. the Swans, and Tadanobu Asano for Shogun. The late Treat Williams was only nominated once before for his turn as Super Agent Michael Ovitz in the 1996 movie The Late Shift. Also in the mix, Barry Keoghan in Masters of the Air, Hugh Grant in The Regime, Christopher Eccleston and Finn Barrett for True Detective Night Country, and Lamorne Forrest in Fargo. And the deserving dark horse is Dave Foley in Fargo. The comedian and character actor brought just the right amount of unflappable pomposity to his eyepatch-wearing lawyer and fixer, Danish Graves. The nominations for the 76th Annual Primetime Emmy Awards will be announced Wednesday, July 17th. The ceremony will air live on Sunday, September 15th on ABC. Those are our very early predictions from Entertainment Weekly for the 2024 Emmys in the main acting categories. And that perfectly wraps up the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. Please come back next week so we can take a look at what Entertainment Weekly has for us next time. Thanks for listening this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And until next week, goodbye.